Welcome to Still Entitled. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
It's the Adam Savage Project.
How are you guys?
We're doing great. We're here in the shop.
Yes, yes. It's a nice weekend day in the shop. Beautiful outside, which means I like working indoors all day.
Yeah, you know, I realized the other day that the only way I found out it was nice outside was when Carl the Fog was tweeting about how much he hates the sun. Do you follow Carl the Fog on Twitter?
No.
He's the San Francisco Fog.
Oh, really?
He's the personification of... of the fog, and he hates the
fogs
sun.
Are grumpy because they're cloud on the ground.
Yeah.
I wish they were in the sky.
Well, and yeah, exactly.
I see. I understand the mythology now.
His relentless grip on the city of San Francisco never stops.
Not in my neighborhood. Not here in the Mission.
That must be nice.
You can sit on my deck and watch the fog come over Twin Peaks and then split north and south, leaving the Mission untouched.
La-dee-da.
So that's why we moved there from Sunnyside. We used to live in Sunnyside, which was named in probably around the turn of the century, and they've been lying about it ever since.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
It is the neck of the city where if you look at San Francisco like a fist, it's the wrist, and this just 18 mile per hour chilly salt breeze just races past that neighborhood 24/7. The Japanese maples we had out front of the house, which we thought were going to be really nice, looked like someone took a blowtorch to them.
Well, the way I judge is if you see rosemary growing wild on the side of the street, it's going to be cold and foggy because it's English.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, there you go.
If Sunnyside is the wrist of the city, what is the Mission?
The Mission's right here in the middle.
It's almost the
really
geographic.
Quite like, central, yeah.
Yeah, like, well, I think the center is like Castro someplace, right? So
I'm not sure.
A little bit over. But yeah, it's
where the fun is.
It's where the sun is and the fun. When we first moved into the Mission a few years ago, it was during Pride weekend.
Oh boy! So, you had a moving van on Pride weekend?
No, okay. It was just the week prior.
Okay,
so we came in on a Friday night, and we had some people over for dinner, and we kept on sending the boys over to Byright because they're a couple blocks away. And my son comes back, and he goes, "It's great out there. Everyone in the world is singing Lady Gaga." and then he says, "Can I go out? Do you need anything else?" And I was thinking, and the boys were like really willing to go out. And I was like, "Why? What? That's weird. Okay, sure. Go out and get some more stuff." And they kept coming back with hors d'oeuvres and things. And then a couple of weeks later, someone said, "Well, you know why they were willing to go back out?" I was like, "Why?" And they're like, "There were probably a lot of boobs on display."
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking.
They might not have been men's boobs. They might not have been female boobs, but they're none the wiser. They were like 10.
It all works out.
And so I go to thing one and thing two after I heard that. And I go to thing one. I say, were there boobies on the street? He goes, "No, not that I..." "No, I really..." You know, genuinely tells me no. I go to thing two, and I'm like, "Were there boobies on the street?" He goes, "Oh, yeah."
I moved into a loft in South of Market at 11th and Folsom the week before Folsom Street Fair. It's a completely different kind of experience.
Yes.
Don't if you're a kid, don't Google that. Just move on. But
no, yeah. Rule 34 applies.
Yeah, I'm going to do the worst segue ever here and say, let's talk. We've got questions.
Okay, let's answer some questions. Questions from the viewers.
Questions from the viewers.
From the viewers.
I'm just going to jump right into it. The first one is Ben wants to know... my question is, where do you draw the line on outsourcing projects? Specifically, how do you make a distinction between skills that you want to learn and skills that are better left to other professionals? Ben's a young filmmaker, and as a result, you know, he's in a situation a lot of times where he's learning all sorts of new stuff. And sometimes he makes dollies, and that turned out great. And sometimes he made a shoulder rig, and that was useless and a big waste of money and made him crazy.
And obviously, you're a special case because you're time constrained.
Right.
So how do you determine when... you know, you want to learn a certain skill versus, you know, it's better to get that project done.
You know, it's often based on enthusiasm and how I do with my first steps gingerly made into learning that skill. It's true, I'm more time constrained than money constrained, so outsourcing on that front isn't as much an issue for me now as it was, but they both have their constraints. You know, I think if there's anything I notice about young filmmakers is they often, because they quote-unquote want to learn, they're not necessarily the best judges. I certainly wasn't when I started making little movies, of where your skills lie. Like, I love editing,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not an editor. Like, I really, like, I have...
But you want to...
I've had like the pleasure of taking a bunch of stuff that I've shot and storyboarded and then shot and then assembling it and learning how precise the timing needs to be for a moment to feel like you don't see what's happening. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't see the editing telling you the story. It's just being told. And I did that enough to know, well, no, this is not the gene pool that I'm in. Editors are very specific. My hat is off to them because I don't understand...
Their brains are wired.
All that stuff in your brain.
It's about being able to concentrate at a level which I have trouble.
So that's a good example of a skill in which while I enjoy editing, I have no qualms about taking something that I've shot, storyboarded, and shot, and giving it to someone to cut together for me.
But you wanted that experience.
Oh yeah, no, and that it was an invaluable experience. So I guess my thing is you should try everything once.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's pleasurable, you should keep on trying it. And if you like the results, but you also should be merciless about how it is. Like, watch it today, and then watch it tomorrow, and then watch it in a week. And I mean, every time you do, you're gonna each time you leave it for a while, you're gonna hate it when you come back to it.
Well, and the other thing I like to do is watch people watching
what
you do. So like, if you take something, you cut it, you think, wow, this is the best I can do, and then you show it to somebody else, and they're like, eh. Yeah, it was okay. Maybe move on. And the same thing applies to other stuff too. Like if you start trying to learn carpentry or joinery or whatever, and you spend hours and hours and hours on it, and you're like, oh, this is pretty good, but you didn't have a blast. Like, it's not fun. It's not satisfying to you. Then drop it and move on.
Do you derive less satisfaction from something, for example, in a prop that you've made versus someone else has made versus something you've made, if even though they can do it much better? Because they've built it many
different
times.
It's a different type of satisfaction. I am certainly less... So to give an example, my Master and Commander coat. Mm-hmm. I love that thing. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece. And I greatly enjoy it. It hangs on the door behind my desk in my home office. And I just like... I like looking at it. If I had built it, I would feel a much deeper sentimental attachment to it, like I do about my Blade Runner gun. So my participation in the final product definitely bears on, you know, whether or not I'd be sad if the building burned down and that was in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, if it's something you've made and something you put hundreds of hours in, then you look at it and you think, it makes you smile every time you look at it.
It really does. It really does. So this question coming from a filmmaker is great because the everyone's making films right now. Mm-hmm. If you're a young filmmaker and you're in film school or you find a group of other filmmakers, there's no shortage of people that you can outsource to. And they're all learning as well.
Yeah.
And you can learn by directing them. You can learn by asking their opinion. I mean, so to me, I'd say, so there's two things about drawing the line. One is, try everything once and then find other people that do it better than you and learn from watching them do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe you end up being an editor. I know editors that didn't intend to end up that way. I know, you know, DPs that didn't intend to end up there, but they found that they loved it after doing it.
Well, I mean, a lot of times I didn't intend to end up doing what I do today.
Yeah.
I mean, I started out doing something because it was fun.
Exactly.
And then it ended up that I was pretty good at it and one thing led to another and here I am.
Yeah.
So, okay. I think
I'd say I'm agnostic about it. You know, there are projects that I won't farm out, but they're few and far between. Like, I've got a beautiful, beautiful, accurate kit of the one of the spinners from Blade Runner, mm-hmm. and it's big. It's like it's got to be 18 inches long with lights and everything. And if I dove into it, it would probably be about 40 or 50 hours of work for me. And I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking how much I want to see it in here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, I'm just never going to get around. I'm not going to get around to that in the next 5 years.
Yeah, it's on the list of things to do that if you're like you're somewhat invalid, but not so much that you can't work, but you're not.
That's why you have kids.
No, they can't tackle that.
Well, you groom
them.
Put them
in the deep end.
I believe I might commission one of my old colleagues from ILM to put it together.
Oh, professionals.
Yeah. Because they'll actually, the guys I know do it much faster than I could, and you know, then it'll be here and it'll be lit. You know,
what about stuff you've done that you absolutely love and it's I mean, it sets you so deep down the path that you ended up learning. Like what's the other side of this?
Well, the other side of this is the Blade Runner gun, or even like the Blade Runner gun case,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that case is incredibly successful to me from a standpoint of going past my own intention of what I wanted when I built it to coming out with something different than I expected. So I look at it and the best stuff that you make when you're done with it, you can't quite remember how you knew how to make it like that.
Yeah.
You know, when it's really good, when you really are satisfied by it, it delves into a kind of an other. And that other, you know, that's art. That's the muse. That's the center of it.
The ineffable.
The ineffable, you know. It's you know, it's the how do you
No, it's you everything. Can't quantify it. Yeah.
It's the other. I refer to it in my head as the other. And it, you know, it's a lovely thing because the pieces that I have pieces in this shop that I made 25 years ago, and they're still teaching me about the way I think about making things because they have so much of that in it.
Well, and then the third category is the stuff that the equipment to do would be prohibitively expensive or unattainable. So like painting or vacuum metallization or stuff like that, you don't necessarily chroming, do because
Yeah, absolutely.
All
right, next question.
Eli wants to know where you stand on the phrase work smart, not hard. He's a farmer and was often told by his dad to ignore that because it's hooey. What do we think?
I think it sounds like a great idea in theory. I don't think anyone...
Ignoring it or the working smart but not hard?
Well, no, sorry. Working smart, not hard is a phrase that sounds good in theory.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone sets out to work dumb.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly seen people work hard and not realizing they were wasting their time.
Ineffectively.
You want to be both.
Yeah.
But you don't want to work smart just so you don't have to work hard.
Well,
there's an argument for that, too, because our friend Brian does that.
What?
Like, he is very smart about how he applies his time.
No, he works hard. Yeah.
He works very hard, in a smart way so that he has a lot of freedom to do other
stuff.
I like
to think that I do the same thing. I think about things for a while, and then I jump in and I tackle them, and, you know, I don't get upset about procrastinating if I'm thinking that I know I'm going to tackle this. I know I'm gestating this. There's not enough people out there who work hard. We've talked about this.
Yes,
we talked about work ethic. So working hard is really great. And working hard, work like busting your ass, really has its place. And its main place is at the beginning of your career in doing anything. Like, you should just be killing yourself.
Well, figuring out what your career is.
Yeah, figuring out what it is. But the one thing that people don't do, and this is the smartest way to work hard as far as I'm concerned, is running a subroutine. And this is what I've always done, is the subroutine is, could I be doing this more efficiently? And it's, I do it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Could I be doing this more efficiently? Could I be doing this faster? Where does what I'm doing fit into the bigger picture? Those three questions are the questions I'm constantly, constantly scrolling through as I'm working on stuff.
Can I do this better, faster?
Why am I doing what am I doing right now?
Right.
The exact thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll even go so far as if I have a really tedious thing to do, like I'm gluing 40 wheels together, I'm like timing myself. Okay, it's 2:30 and I've glued 24 of them.
You, that means you map
done
that out.
Four and, and the math is actually one of the ways in which I meditate while doing.
Well, and then sometimes I'll do part of one batch one way and try it the other way. Like I'll do it A, B, C, D, E, and then I'll do A, 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 B, 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 B,
absolutely.
And see which way is faster. And I mean, that's part of the fun.
Totally. Like,
if you're mowing, you know, you try to figure out how you get your fastest lap.
I think if you can work hard without working smart, but if you work hard long enough, the smarts come.
They come, but you do need to ask yourself, what am I doing? It's like you do need to run a subroutine that says, am I doing this right? Am I doing it fast enough? Could I be doing it more efficiently? Because I see... You know, I had to tell our shop guys at MythBusters, unless I say that the measurements matter, don't measure.
Just
if I say, cut me a piece of wood that's 2 feet long with a hole in either end, don't pull out a tape measure. That just means a piece of wood about this long with a hole in either end.
So blueprints matter, otherwise just eyeball.
Exactly.
Okay, there you go. Christoph wants to know, he was visiting our about page on the site. I didn't even know we had an about page on the site, but I guess we must have read that at some point. And it says that you were restoring a car.
Well,
so he wants to know if the car was possibly that beautiful Volvo 245 and how far into the project you are in a little background.
Well, no. The Volvo 245 that I wrote about in Wired last year with clouds all over, that was my first car bought in 1990. It was a 78 245 DL. I loved that car. We destroyed a couple of Volvo station wagons yesterday Mythbusters. I can't say why. But what was great about them is that sitting in that Volvo, it smelled like my early 20s.
Really?
Right? Like that just smelled.
Oh, so what? Describe what's the smell.
Well, it's
your Ratatouille.
It's Mercedes also smell like European cars of that era all have this kind of smell of the leather and the vinyl and the plastic and the sun.
It's a specific leather treatment or something,
the
right?
The smell of European polymer chains being slowly destroyed by the sun. Wow.
This is cologne you need
and
to get.
I learned to work on cars on that car. That was the car that taught me. That was what the Wired article was about. I have a car which has been fully restored. It's a 1982 BJ42 short wheelbase Land Cruiser.
Cool.
It is from it's from New Zealand, so it's right-hand drive. Wow. It's beautiful. And I had it fully restored from the studs on up, except for the engine, which is dying. And not only is it dying, this thing is a beast. It's a beautiful Land Cruiser. There's pictures of it in my Twitter feed. I'll send you guys some to post on the site for this. And it's gorgeous. And it'll climb a muddy wall in the rain.
Oh, yeah.
The torque on this thing on the four-wheel drive is incredible. But it's the engine, if I'm not remembering incorrectly, is like under 80 horsepower. You can't get above 45 in a headwind.
So I learned how to drive a manual transmission on not the short wheel, but the long one from the same era. And I mean, it was literally like first gear was to 3 miles an hour or something like that. And then you shift into, you basically took off in second.
Yeah. Yeah. I mostly take off in second. So
maybe it was a 5-speed. I can't remember, but yeah.
I want to put a new engine in it. And I mean a new engine and a new engine. I'd love to put a very modern engine in the thing. There's a place up in Northern California, Mudraki, I think, where those guys, I've been talking to them. They've been looking for a more modern, like a mid-90s Land Cruiser engine because those swap in really nicely. Mm-hmm. We haven't been able to find one. Oh, listeners on Tested, if someone has a bead on a mid-90s Land Cruiser engine that'll fit in mine, diesel, it's diesel, and it's got two tanks, which is awesome. That doesn't matter for the engine. But yeah, I'm looking for an engine.
Does it have a snorkel? Or is it the snorkel one?
It does. It's got the full snorkel. Nice. You drive it up to its hood ornament in water.
Nice. I talked to a friend of mine years ago about doing electrical conversions for old, like late 70s Land Sharks, basically, like the big square convertibles. We looked at it, and like the math on that is so bad because those cars weighed 6,000 pounds.
Yeah,
anyway.
I love this car. I did a lot of work on it. Did all the carpeting interior myself. Did the ceiling and
headliner and the whole thing.
It's beautiful. I've got some great stickers on. I love it. It's just sitting in a parking lot here in the Mission, waiting for me to find an engine and to send it to go swap out. I'll tell you, and I know this is blasphemous, but since I'm in my mid-40s and like I don't like bending over to tie my shoes anymore because I'm old, I would almost consider throwing an automatic in it. Now, I know there's a bunch of Land Cruiser owners that just clutch their pearls out there, but I want a daily driver.
Send your angry letters to...
Listen, if you've got a nice, you know, diesel engine that could be thrown into my Land Cruiser, let us know.
I guess you couldn't put a gas engine in it, huh?
What's that?
You could put a gas engine in it, right?
Yeah, the conversion would actually be really expensive. Oh, okay. It's more expensive to go from gas to diesel, but you'd still have to swap out a whole bunch of crap in the car to do that. I want to stay with diesel.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially with the two tanks, and I'm not positive about this, but someone told me this, is that I could run biodiesel in the rear tank and regular diesel in the front tank and basically start the car on diesel, swap to biodiesel, run it on biodiesel, and then like 5 minutes before I'm done driving, swap back to the front tank to flush it out.
Wow.
Which could be awesome. You'll
smell like French fries everywhere you go.
Wouldn't that be great?
I love French fries. Eric wants to know... Okay. So we did the Born Bag video a few months ago. People really liked that, and it was pretty successful on YouTube. We get a lot of email about it.
That's so awesome.
First thing I'm going to say is we know the dimensions of the French driver's license. We're
all
good.
All the different
totally
sizes. Thank you, everybody who reached out. All of that. All of your advice is great, especially because French driver's licenses are similar to many other European driver's licenses, all of which were different sizes.
Yeah, I mean, even within the same years, we had several people who are French cops write in and say, hey, They're all a little different. So way to go. It's all different now because it's all Euro standard, whatever. Eric says, hey, I have an idea on what the knife was in the Bourne bag. I'm pretty sure it's a Victorinox Mauser, which was made for the German army and is no longer in production. Coupled by its rarity, it's a tough find. That said, he has seen a few kicking around eBay from time to time.
All right.
And yeah,
we'll write that down and take a look.
Yeah. So there were a couple of other people who suggested different, potential knives.
I actually bought one on the RPF recently, from a guy, and it's much closer than the one that I had.
Yeah.
I still haven't gone over the screenshots to see if it's dead on the money.
And with the knife, since he doesn't unfold it, it's going to be hard to tell in a lot of cases anyway.
Exactly.
But yeah, so that's it. We're good on French driver's license dimensions.
Thank you.
Probably more email than anything we've ever done on testing came in as a result of that.
And we
appreciate it.
None of it's not appreciated. Yeah. All that, information is great.
If anything, it makes you feel better that we got probably 200 different responses and they were all a little bit different. So you were close. Noah says, I'm a high school student who's looking at careers, and I'm very interested in making things, especially props. I'd like to go into hard-edge model making. What kind of degree and overall advice do you recommend?
Oh, man, that is tough. That is tough, especially because...
Is there a lot of jobs in hard edge model making at this point?
No, there's not. There's not a lot of jobs in hard edge model making. They didn't. They even eschewed making miniatures in the new Lord of the Rings film. And Weta was one of the last places that was making really large scale bigatures, is what they called them. So there is still some of that work. It is few and far between, which means to get that work, you need to be at the top of your game. The prop work, there's more of that because practical props are always going to be needed.
Swords and armor and
devices, and time travel stuff or whatever, is conceived of
period
in the film.
Piece stuff.
Is that work that you could do and learn, would that give you the skill to do something that's more in demand?
Well, I'm not even sure the place in which you would get into that, you'd almost be doing it from an art direction standpoint. Like, there is making props, which when you say, oh, I'd like to make props for a living, there's making props, in which if you want to do that, you can do it for theater all day long. Theater always needs props, and, you're going to get $10 and 3 days to make something really complex. But it's a great training ground. If you want to make props for movies, you could try and get hired by a prop shop, but again, work is going to be tight. It's not going to be constant, but you're going to get more work if you turn out to also be a great designer.
Okay.
So to me, I would say the intersection for that is to go into design. And if you really are interested in the model making and the props, clearly that means you're interested also in multidisciplinary skills. And in that case, I would look for a school that not only had a solid design program, but look for a degree within that design school that gave you access to the largest number of departments in that school. Mm.
Okay.
So you could go,
So whether it's like a fine arts multidisciplinary thing or...
Right.
Yeah.
So if it's mixed media where you learn your design skills or, again, I haven't looked at the syllabi of art schools lately, what SVA or
that's Parsons coming soon. You have a few years.
Yes. The boys just turned 14. But again, some of the smartest people I know have chosen their degrees not because of the job they wanted when they were done. They've chosen it for what they would learn while they were there.
Yeah.
So a friend of mine went to MIT and specifically chose the department that gave him access to almost every other department at MIT and thus was able to get his hands dirty with everything.
And the thing about going to college is The classes are the least important part of it's the other stuff you learn.
Yes.
I mean, the thing I tell people who don't know what they want to do when they go into college is to find an avocation, not a vocation,
right,
out of college. Because, odds are you're going to end up doing something that's completely off your degree anyway.
And in that case also, we could talk just very briefly about the egregious cost of college, which is ridiculous and angers me every time I think about it.
Yeah, 60 grand now for...
Ridiculous. Yeah. And there's a really good argument to be made for something my wife and a bunch of my friends did, which was go to a really inexpensive school for the first couple of years to figure out what the hell it is that you're somewhat interested in.
Or take a year off and get a job and
that's like fantastic to do.
Because I was much more prepared to go when I was 19 to manage living by myself than when I was 18.
Yeah.
You know, my wife went to state for 2 years before figuring out where she wanted to go. And we have several friends in Bay Area who did that. Come go to community college for a couple of years just to figure it out.
Well, and take the bullshit classes in the community college. Take the stuff like Western civilization.
And those necessary classes to come pass, not pass.
Yeah.
Oh, they can do. You can do that now.
Pass that pass for the breath classes.
Wow! And once again, the caveat is that I'm giving advice about going to college, and I never went there myself.
Well, it's the thing: you go to college, and then you always want to go. You wish you could have gone later in life.
Well, you know, I'm a little bit shamefaced at what an arrogant little sod I was back then.
Well. We didn't know you back then.
Oh, you're really glad you didn't know me back then.
You wouldn't have tolerated our BS back then. The other thing I was to say is if you want to find a way to do stuff and have other people help fund your habit. So on the RPF a lot of times and in other places, like our friend Harrison Cricks, Bulpin Props, has built a business of making props. Basically by having people commission stuff, and he's learned a lot of stuff along the way.
Absolutely.
And that's a good way to learn that stuff.
In fact, when I was freelancing, when I was in the mid-90s, early 90s through the late 90s, through the early 2000s was my freelancing days, about 12 years, 14 years. I would have a price structure where I'd often say to people, they would say, we don't have enough money to do this. And I'd say, great, I will build it for you for your budget if you cover materials, but I get to keep it when we're done.
Yeah.
And that meant that I got to really lay into something because I knew it was going to be mine. It was going to be cool. It was going to be a design of mine. And yet they were covering materials, which was the expensive part for me doing my stuff at home. $50 means a lot when you're 22 and you've got to buy them art. You know, you've got to spend that on art.
If you can find somebody who'll supply tools and materials, go nuts.
And that's theater and that's film. I mean, I built an entire padded cell for a friend's senior thesis film at NYU for something like $25. Because that's all that we had. And that refined my brain, you know, that limitation. That's just... Finding those ways to just get access to materials and get your hands dirty is great. We're almost there.
I think we're on time. So on that note, thank you, as always, Adam.
Absolutely.
If you have questions, the email address is podcast@tested.com. Use the subject line, questions for Adam, and we will come back and do more questions at some point in the future.
If you have advice about a Land Cruiser engine that will fit my BJ42 diesel, please put Adam's new diesel engine in the email.
I will just set up a filter to send those directly to you. And as always, thanks for iTunes reviews and all that stuff. Yes. Everything you do to help, whether it's giving criticism or comments or whatever, helps us with the show.
Photos of the car will be untested.
Of the car will be up untested. Absolutely.
Excellent. We'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Bye.